is 100,000 times smaller than the outer ring of electrons on the hydrogen or helium molecule. Amazing. If you made a molecule, if you took a hydrogen molecule and blew it up in size so that the size of the Wembley Stadium in London, which is 1,000 meters in diameter, the nucleus of that blown up hydrogen atom would be something like an eighth of an inch in diameter in the middle of that field. Gives you a little bit of feeling of how small is the target of a nucleus of an atom and why doing nuclear research is so difficult. It is such an extremely small target to hit that the scientists, the first thing the scientists start talking about, the nuclear scientists, is cross-sectional area. Yeah, I've got this beautiful beam of particles coming out of my particle accelerator, and I'm shooting them into this atom or molecule, and I want them to hit the nucleus. And what's the probability they're going to hit the nucleus? And you start calculating the areas, and you realize, my goodness, is that a hard, small target to hit. And so gamma rays, let me figure out what the wavelength could be of a gamma ray. If the upper end of optical is 300 nanometers, and a gamma ray is at least two or three orders of magnitude above that, we're talking about sub-nanometer wavelength of gamma rays. And there's no reason to believe that that's the end of the electromagnetic spectrum. That just happens to be the end of where we've built detectors and put them in space and start measuring those particles. So you feel that you run out of spectrum when you start getting down to those particles. When the wavelength starts approaching the size of the particles inside of an atom, you seem to be saying there's a limit. I'm not so sure about that one, Glenn.
That is correct.
KCQQRQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, gamma is tens of nanometers thick. So, you know, you're not sub-nanometer yet. And as I said, if on the space station they were detecting something smaller than one nanometer, what element on the periodic chart would they be using that's smaller than, I mean, a typical atom is 3 to 1 nanometer. At that point, that's the smallest atom that you could possibly have. What would they be using in a detector? Most of the atoms that are used in detectors for electromagnetic detection are much greater than 1 nanometer in size. They're closer to 3 nanometers, but atoms, not molecules. So, here again, I think that, as I said, I'm being a little bit bold, but I think I'm on some pretty solid concrete here when I say 1 nanometer electromagnetic wave is pretty much finished at that point. I don't think that there's any possibly due to generate one there or detect it in either direction. But again, I always love to be proven wrong in that one, but I don't think that I will be. Casey, if you like it.
You seem to feel that there's a sound barrier there, Glenn, and maybe you're right, although each one of these sound barriers eventually gets broken. And by the way, when the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland, CERN is the name of the organization, but it's in Switzerland. I can't think of the name of the town in Switzerland where it's located. It doesn't matter. They've got these huge detectors. And by the way, when I was at that conference last Sunday, they handed me this beautiful stereo viewer, which has got a picture of the Atlas detector inside the stereo viewer. You hold this thing up to your face and you get this beautiful picture in three dimensions of what the Atlas looks like. And my wife was asking when she looked at it, what's that little stick down at the bottom, a tiny little black blob? And as we looked at it closer, we realized it was a human being standing there as a size comparison for this Atlas detector. This Atlas detector, it really is a calorimeter. When you smash these particles of the clockwise ring and the counterclockwise going particles in the ring, when you smash them together and you get these things coming out of there, you want to figure out what they are. They are going into the so-called calorimeter. These individual particles trace a particular path, and the path that they detect, they trace, if it's curved to the right or the left, tells you in the case of the magnetic field that's nearby that the particle was positively charged or negatively charged. And if it suddenly changes the way its trajectory works, maybe the particle flipped into something else. Let me drop a
quick comment there.
But what they're really detecting is calorimetry. They're detecting the amount of heat that is generated when the particle penetrates the individual chunks of material in their detector. That is not a coherent superheterodyne detector, which is looking at wavelength. It's looking at energy. And that's good enough for them. If they know the trajectory of the particle, the amount of energy of the particle, how far it travels, how fast it travels, they stand a chance of figuring out what it is. They haven't really worried about its wavelength, per se. So you can build fermionic detectors, calorimetry-type detectors, where you measure the heat increase. In fact, the pixels that are inside of many of our cameras really work by that means, the heat that's generated when the photon of energy hits that particular particle. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
If a good product for that, you might be right. We don't have a detector for dark energy or dark matter yet. So when that comes about, maybe we will find out.
Glenn is proposing that there's a kind of a wavelength limit of around a nanometer. When you go to higher and higher frequencies, shorter and shorter wavelength, Glenn is sort of saying you can't get beyond a nanometer. In today's technology, he's probably right. Is that going to be the ultimate sound barrier in the future? You can tell I'm skeptical. Every time mankind thought there was a sound barrier, on the highest frequency you could go to, you read these articles about the guys in QST magazine in 1925. They were taking the equivalent of an 807 tube, removing the bottom of the socket of the tube to remove its capacitance, getting down to the individual wires coming out of the glass bulb, to lower the capacitance in order to have efficient transmission up at the higher frequency then of 14 megacycles. They were modifying the hardware that they had to get up to that super high frequency of 14 megacycles. We've come a long way. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Glenn is right. But I'm going to surprise you even more. And I wonder what Glenn is going to say. Light, electricity, and magnetism are manifestations of the same thing called electromagnetic radiation. So now we're including magnetism in it. What are you going to say about it, Glenn?
I'm not sure that Jen heard. I'm not sure that Glenn heard a question there. Let's see if Glenn is still there. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. I'm not sure that there might be a question there, Glenn. Tell us anything that's on your mind on the subject. You got it, Glenn. Yeah, maybe Glenn got called away. We've kept John waiting an awful long time. Let me go over to him, the last guy who signed it. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform. I hope all this jazz hasn't put you to sleep, John. K2RIW, you got the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, K2IRW. This is KD2FQU, John. My question is a duplexer for the Yaesu 857D.
Okay. You've mentioned a piece of hardware, duplexer for 857D. Is there a question in there, John?
Yes, the question is, what would be a good duplexer? Because I have an ATOS 120. I managed to actually get that working for the HF. I got a diamond mount K400C off my car, and actually the noise is not bad, but I wanted to combine the 2 meter and 440 with just the ATOS, which is operating currently for the HF side of the radio, and I wanted to know if anybody had an opinion for maybe a Comet CF416B or any diamond duplexer or any duplexer that allows a DC pass on both sides.
Okay, you're adding another ingredient here. You said at the end DC pass on both sides. Are you trying to transmit DC voltage through the coaxial cable that goes through the duplexer to the antennas, as if you had a preamplifier at the antenna and you were powered by the coaxial cable? Is that the question you're asking, John? Go ahead.
No. When I spoke with Yaesu about a week and a half ago, they told me as long as the duplexer allowed DC pass to through the coax to the ATOS, because the ATOS tunes itself by electric by the DC current from the 857G. So for 40 meters, 30 meters, and so forth.
Okay, I'm a little light now on this particular piece of commercial equipment. Are you telling me that the ATOS is a remotely tunable antenna tuner by which you send a coax, a DC voltage up the coax cable to do the tuning? Is that what you're asking, John? Go ahead.
No, I already know that the ATOS requires power to go up and down to tune. But it is a tunable. It's through the Yaesu radio. Yaesu's technician told me as long as the duplexer allows DC current to pass through on the HF side and on the 2 meter 440 side in order to adjust, then it's okay.
6DC's here with a comment.
Now, I was going to pass it over to you, but we're beyond 9 o'clock and I didn't think you'd be there. You got the floor, Hal.
Yeah, I have an idea what his problem is. I don't have time to explain it to him now, but if he does give me a call tomorrow, I can maybe give him an answer how he can get away using the ATIS for what he wants to do.
It sounds to me like you want to obtain a duplexer for 440 and 2 meters, for instance. In other words, this is a dual band rig. It's got one output connector, but you've got two separate antennas on the roof, so to speak. And you want to separate the signals going there, and a duplexer will do that for you. And you probably want to do it with a commercially off-the-shelf available duplexer. You're willing to write a check and make the problem go away. If you were sufficiently curious, a duplexer is not rocket science. In theory, you could build your own duplexer. If you Google the word duplexer, diplexer, duplexer, whatever, I have seen quite a number of articles on how to build them, how to homebrew them. And so the actual number of the dollars of materials that goes in there is probably less than $20, so to speak, to homebrew one, if you wanted to. But that would be a science project. It would take you some time. It's a good learning curve to learn how a duplexer works. It really is a, you could do it with a high-pass filter and a low-pass filter. For instance, let me drop. The better way to do it is a 2 meter bandpass filter and a 440 bandpass filter that both come together at a junction, and there's a particular length of wiring required to those two separate filters, so that in the best of all worlds, when you're on 2 meters and the signal is passing into the 2 meter filter, you want the signal that tries to go down the path to the 440 filter, you want it to see a open circuit and vice versa, so that one does not interfere with the other. And there's a whole design procedure by which that can be done. So, as I see it, you've got the choice of doing a little bit of research and homebrewing it, or look at all the available commercial products in duplexer, and hopefully the data sheet from the manufacturer tells you whether or not a DC signal will pass through there. I'm probably saying things that are overly obvious and maybe a little too simplistic, John. KD2, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform. I'm K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. You got it, John.
Thank you. But it's actually the reverse. The ATOS handles both from 40 meters up to 440. I wanted to combine the signals from 857 for both sides just to work off one antenna. That's all I wanted to know, but looking up that information probably would take me about a month and some change to create.
Although the answer may be a little bit complicated, let me find out now just a headline, so to speak, how, now that we understand a little bit more about what John is trying to do, do you believe there is a solution that's not going to take $1 zillion for John to do it? K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW and TechNet, K6DPZ. If he gives me a call tomorrow and explains the problem, I'll give him a simple solution to how he can get away with it. Right now, I'm 20 minutes over my time. I got to run. K6DPZ.
Before you go, Hal, what's the easiest way he can find your phone number?
Richard gave you my site. That will tell you what you want to know.
Okay, so your phone number is at that site. which was www.landaircom.com. LANDAIRCOM.COM. So you go to that particular website, get that particular phone number, talk to Hal, and apparently he's got the super sauce, the secret sauce that's going to do it for you, John. KD2, Foxtrot Quebec Uniform, if you need any fills. K2RIW and the Tech Man. My name is Dick.
Thank you very much, Dick. I will go to the website and give Hal a call tomorrow. I'll get that information. I do appreciate the attentive answer. It actually opens up some other areas that I can look into for homebrews later on. But I have a simple mobile setup and trying to still keep it simple.
As we all slowly discovered, John, the word simple is very relative. In many cases, if you think the problem is simple, you probably don't understand the problem. Mother Nature has not made this universe easy for us to understand. That wasn't her motivation. I hope, John, that you've had a chance to keep track of who has signed in. I hope we haven't missed anybody that wants to get an edge in word-wise, so to speak, on Echo Link. On top of that, John, it's time for you to go to the mailbag. KC2 WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2 WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, Al, everybody on the net tonight. I am monitoring Echo Link right now. I think there's 5 in queue. Nobody's asking any questions. We even have Rob from Mexico signed in. So, a little activity. And I will be monitoring this in the future. I hope this works out. It seems to be doing fine. And I do switch occasionally over to the chat room to see if anything's there. And that is extremely quiet. Nobody's signed in there. Okay, enough of that. Let me let it drop and I'll go on to my first question. Okay, got a young amateur who's into boating, and he wants to know about radio direction finding at sea. He's learned to work a sextant, and he's pretty good with that. But he wants to know what you think and the accuracy of radio direction finding. What do you think the true resolution is? Right now he's using AM stations. He has both a Bendix and a Raytheon RDF units, and they seem to work pretty well. But he's wondering what you think, how accurate for navigation is it? So maybe you could give him a little rundown on that, and maybe some way he could improve it. So over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
When it comes to radio direction finding from an aircraft, which is a very severe environment, one of the most difficult problems in the world that was assigned to Airborne Instruments Laboratory way back in the dark ages of 1960-something, when Kelly Johnson at the Skunk Works of Lockheed was inventing the thing that we now know as the SR-71 airplane. And the company that won the contract to build the RDF on that system was AIL. And there was a genius of a guy, I'll think of his name in a minute, who invented something called the double dual interferometer. The bottom line is, by radio direction finding techniques, and this thing worked from, I believe the low end was 500 megahertz, and the high end was 20 gigahertz. Across that frequency region, this double dual interferometer receiver thing gave you 1 degree azimuth accuracy in radio direction finding. You fly that airplane near somebody's territory at, let me pick the number, 75,000 feet. You fly a straight line, and you keep track of the angle of arrival of the signals as you fly by. And now you're getting the signal from the 1 o'clock area of the airplane, so to speak. And a little bit later, you're getting the signal from the 3 o'clock area. A little bit later, you're seeing the signal at 4:30 coming into the airplane. And you plot all those lines as you fly the airplane, and by way of very fancy navigation, you know where you are, you know what path you're flying, and you know the angle of arrival. And you draw all of those lines on a map, so to speak. And pretty soon you realize all those lines cross at one particular point, and that's where that emitter was. Well, they weren't drawing lines on the map. They were doing the computer-generated equivalent of that. Let me drop. So that receiver system that I worked on has 1 degree of accuracy across a whole lot of different frequencies. It took different spiral antennas from the different frequency regions to do that. There was a low, medium, and high frequency design of the spirals, and four of those spirals for each individual band, so to speak, did all that. What's really happening here is that of all the techniques for radio direction finding, the simplest one is where you realize the antenna has got a three-dimensional antenna pattern. A Yagi-like antenna has a three-dimensional antenna pattern that if you could see the antenna pattern in space, it would look like a cucumber. Let me drop. And that's an amplitude-detecting direction-finding system. And as you wave that antenna back and forth and you peak the signal on the bore site of that antenna, and then you sweep the antenna a little bit to the right and a little bit to the left, and you realize how fast the signal is falling off, and you plot that, you can probably get 5 or 10 degrees of accuracy, if it's done carefully in a clean environment, by simple amplitude comparison. The next step beyond that is interferometry. If you have two antennas side by side, separated by some fraction or a little bit more of a wavelength, and you measure the phase difference of the signals arriving at these two antennas, you've now got something called a baseline, what would you call that, moment arm between the two antennas, and as you make the distance between the two antennas greater and greater, the angular resolution gets higher and higher. And if you made the distance between the two antennas roughly 35 wavelengths in that simple system I'm describing, you would have better than 1 degree of accuracy. That's the good news. As you separate the two antennas further and further, you get higher and higher angular accuracy, but you have more and more ambiguity. You may think that you're looking at this interferometry antenna pattern, which is a bunch of fingers in space, and you think your signal is arriving by the middle finger, but it's really one side lobe over to the right or one side over to the left, and you didn't know that. What the geniuses, Bob Goodwin, I'm thinking of his name now. I think Goodwin was his name. Robert Goodwin is the guy who invented the system. And by having not one pair of antennas as an interferometer, he had two pairs of antennas. He had a reference antenna, one antenna to the right as the near distance, and another antenna further to the right as the far distance. By using a pair of interferometers, that's why it was called a double-dual interferometer.
Repeater, timeout.
By using a pair of antennas in that manner, let me drop. By using a total of three antennas, I think in one case he even had four, you now have the outer spacing that gives you all of the angular resolution you like. You've got the inner spacings of the other antennas that resolve the ambiguity, and you put it all together, you've now got very high probability of 1 degree accuracy with no ambiguity on direction finding. When it comes to making antennas that are narrow in beamwidth, when it comes to antennas that are very sensitive to small changes in angle of arrival, you have to devote real estate. That's the laws of physics. You have to apply real estate to the problem. There has to be real antenna area, whether it's the spacing of two antennas as an interferometer or whether it's the size of the horn or the dish and you make the dish bigger. You take the number of wavelengths of diameter of a parabolic dish or the number of wavelengths of the width of a feed horn or of a horn antenna, divide that number of wavelengths into 70 degrees. That tells you the beam width. Let me drop. Let me give you an example. I've got a horn that is 10 wavelengths wide. I divide the 10 wavelengths into 70 degrees. The answer is 7. I will have a 3 dB beam width of roughly 7 degrees if my horn or my dish antenna happens to be 10 wavelengths wide, and I'm using it correctly. So more and more angular resolution, more and more angular accuracy requires more and more real estate. There is essentially no other solution to that. There is a system that was proposed where not only the two antennas side by side are you measuring the phase difference between the two, there's also a technique called time of arrival, time difference of arrival, TDA, I think it's called time difference of arrival, TDA. SDA. If you've got two separate receivers connected to the two separate antennas, and now you look at which antenna gets the signal first, and so there's some kind of an edge to the modulation of the signal so that you've got something to use as a reference, by looking at the difference in time of arrival of the signal of the two antennas, you can again get very high accuracy of angle of arrival. However, you'll notice that that also requires real estate. The bottom line is, if you're willing to devote enough real estate, in the case of a real good, long, very long baseline radio telescope, very, very long baseline interferometer, where you've got one antenna in Hawaii and another antenna in London, so to speak, and you've got both antennas looking at the same point in the sky, now you can get milli degrees of accuracy. Like, as you can tell, they have, let me drop it. As you can tell, they've used a lot of real estate to do it. The number of wavelengths between the edges of the antenna or the two separate antennas, if you're using an interferometer, the number of wavelengths, by the laws of physics, tells you exactly what angular accuracy is achievable. You can't get something for nothing. You can't make a microscopic antenna that's going to give you a milli degree of angular accuracy, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, very good. I'm sure he'll have a lot of interesting fun with this. People are just using GPS, and this guy's taking the long way around. But it sounds like a fun thing to do. And the fact that he got a few lessons in using his sextant, and he's doing well with that. So I wish him luck with that. And maybe he could build a nice antenna. The boat's pretty large, so he might be able to get something up there with some good resolution. All right, let me drop, and I'll go on to the next. Okay, Dick. Jim signed in on the chat room last week with this question concerning a three-element Yagi. He'd like to know the relationship between the reflector and the director, how that actually works. So maybe you might want to give them a complete thing on a three-element Yagi and the functions of those elements. And like I said, that was last week, and I did not have the time switching back and forth to present that problem that came in late, or I viewed it late. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, of all the patents that I have filed for on antennas, a three-element Yagi operating at 915 megacycles is my favorite. Mr. Hindusugu Yagi invented the Yagi in 1928 and patented then. And along comes this guy with a lot of chutzpah named K2LIW. In 2004, he re-patents a Yagi antenna. I'm not the only guy that's re-patented a Yagi. You make a big enough number of changes to the design of a Yagi, and we think we did, me and the group of guys that were doing this project, we got a patent issued on a more modern kind of a Yagi. A Yagi consists of a driven element that acts like a dipole. And you adjust the length of that driven element, and you find some way of feeding signal to it, whether it be by gamma match, T match, folded dipole, direct feed of the dipole, whatever. There's a zillion ways you can feed the dipole. As long as you carry out all the fine details, all of them work essentially equally well. So you've got a resonant dipole in the middle of the antenna. The director that's out in front of it is a dipole-like structure that's parasitic, meaning it doesn't connect to anything. It has no feed line. And it is made shorter than the resonant length. The thing out in front called director is above the resonant frequency, or below the resonant wavelength, so to speak. You've made it a shorter element, and you call it director, and the reflector, you make it longer. In general, the reflector is longer than the driven element. In general, the director is shorter than the driven element. The magic of the Yagi process is that I'm going to now look at it from the point of view of the transmitter. I'm going to drop. The dipole is issuing a signal in almost all directions, so to speak. It certainly is issuing a signal both forward and reversed with equal amplitude. The dipole has no choice. It's doing that. Of the signal that hits the reflector, because the reflector is longer than wavelength, longer than the resonant length, it has a inductive reactance. It is a delaying device. The signal being re-radiated by the reflector is shifted later in time because that element is longer than the resonant frequency. So the signal being re-radiated by the reflector happens to be of the right phase angle that it tends to cancel the signal going further rearward on the antenna. So the dipole is issuing a signal that's going rearward. The reflected signal off the reflector is issuing a signal that's going rearward. And those two signals are approximately 180 degrees out of phase, and you get cancellation. The reflector electronically cancels the signal that you and I would call the back lobe of the antenna. The director does the opposite. The director is shorter in wavelength, in physical length, than the right wavelength, and it gives you a capacitive reactance, and it gives you a leading phase angle. So therefore, of the signal coming out of the dipole that goes forward, and the signal coming out of the director, because it can't stop reflecting, if you know what I mean, everything that is near resonance will give you an absorption and re-radiation. The director does that. A parasitic element does absorption and re-radiation. Let me drop it. So when you now analyze what's going on in the forward direction of the antenna, and you sit out in front of the antenna, and by some magic you're able to see the two separate signals. One signal is coming from the dipole directly. One signal is being absorbed by the director and re-radiated, and it's also coming to you. And you suddenly realize that those two signals going forward are in phase with each other. They amplify each other. They support each other. So the magic of the dipole, the magic of the Yagi process, when the lengths of the parasitic elements are the right length and the positions in three-dimensional space are the right positions, you get enhancement of the signal going forward. You get cancellation of the signal going rearward. You could have done that if you wanted to as an end-fire phased array antenna. Let me drop. You could literally make a Yagi-like antenna by making three separate dipoles. And by feeding the right amplitude and the right phase angle of the signal going to the most forward dipole, the right amplitude and phase angle of the signal going to the middle dipole, and the right amplitude and phase angle of the signal going to the rear dipole, you could again set it up as a phased array, which enhances the signal going forward and cancels the signal going backward. You could do it with three separate feed lines and a 3-to-1 power divider and a phase matching network. The magic of the Yagi is that all of that hardware are feeding those other two parasitic elements, and all the hardware connected to them to do it isn't required. Just by putting passive elements out there, you get 95% of that benefit of making three separate driven dipole-like structures to make a so-called end-fire phased array antenna. Let me drop. Now, when it comes to a three-element Yagi, the theory I've just given you of enhancement of the signal going forward and cancellation of the signal going backward by this proper phase angle of reflected signal off of those parasitic elements, for a three-element Yagi, that works pretty well. The next question is, you're going to ask what happens. Okay, this guy RIW came up with a 19-element Yagi that an awful lot of people are using worldwide, and some of them are fairly happy with it. What happens when you've got 19 elements, where you've got a driven element, two separate reflectors, and let me think, 19 minus 3 is 16 directors out front. Are all those directors all doing that reflecting and enhancing? And the answer is almost no. When it comes to a long Yagi, the theory of operation changes. And a very logical question you could ask is, where does that transition occur? Does it occur when you go from 3 elements to 5 elements, 6 elements? Where does the transition occur? Before I tell you about the transition, let me tell you the philosophy of this one. In the case of a very long Yagi, like a 19-element Yagi, 16 directors out there, two reflectors and one driven element, what's really going on? All of the directors are shorter than a resonant length. They all are giving you a capacitor reactance. As such, if I'm now talking about the antenna in the reception mode, because here, whether you analyze the antenna as a transmitter or a receiver, you use the one that works in your mind the best. Because of the law of reciprocity, they both work, but you analyze it in the way that works best for you. When it comes to a long Yagi, in my opinion, it is easier to analyze it as a receiving antenna. So here's a signal coming in from space. It's some of the signal is going down the center of the boom of this long Yagi with 19 elements, and it starts encountering those directors. Those directors are all capacitive loading devices. They're all slightly higher in frequency, which gives them a capacitive reactance that constitutes a slow wave structure. The signal flowing down the center of the boom of that long Yagi moves slower than the speed of light. The signal that's further away from the boom, above it, below it, to the left of it, or the right of it, that's flowing in that same direction, the signal being further away from those directors doesn't get slowed down as much. That slow wave function is really giving you focusing. If you could plot the planar wavefront that came in from space, let me drop this. You'll recognize that planar wavefront that came in from space, as it starts progressing down the deeper and deeper into that Yagi from the forward end of it, the wave is starting to become concave from the driven element's point of view. Because the portion of the wave going down the center of the boom is being slowed down more than the wave that's further away from the boom, the wave is starting to take on concave wavefront. Huygens' principle dictates that once you determine the planar wavefront, or just in the case it's a curved wavefront, microscopically each little portion of the wave must radiate at right angles to its phase front. So therefore you can envision this cup-shaped wave, this concave wave, viewed from the center of the Yagi. You're looking at that wave, it's now got a concave shape, and therefore the signal is coming to a focus at the driven element, very similar to what your magnifying glass does. You can analyze a magnifying glass as having a refractive index, and therefore it's bending the signal. That's one way of looking at it. There's a better way of looking at it. Let me drop. The signal that flows down the center of your magnifying glass has gone through a thicker portion of glass. It's being slowed down more. The portion of the light wave coming into your magnifying glass near its perimeter is going through a thinner piece of glass. It's slowed down less. The wave being slowed down more in the center of your magnifying glass is starting to take on a concave wave shape when viewed from the focal point. And that's how the sunlight going through your magnifying glass gets focused down to a point where you've aimed it at the newspaper, and now you're burning a hole in the newspaper. Is it because the wave got bent by the refractive index of the glass, or the refractive index of the glass really is velocity of propagation? The fact that the magnifying glass is thicker in the center slows down the wave more, it takes on a concave wave shape, and therefore it does focusing. Which is doing it? The answer is both. Use whichever one works for you. It's just two different ways of analyzing the exact same phenomena. As you can see, there is a strong relationship between a long Yagi and a magnifying glass. They're both doing the exact same thing. And here's another piece of evidence that fits that model. Let me drop. What I did to come up with that 19-element Yagi, I started off with the best Yagi in the world, the Gunterhach DL6WU 16-element Yagi. And I started adding more elements to it. You think just adding more elements does it? Absolutely not. You add more elements in front of the antenna, you suddenly realize, if you've got the right kind of test equipment, that all of the elements have to be made a little bit shorter when you add more to them. What you're really doing is you're building a magnifying glass with a longer focal length. Your Yagi antenna used to be 10 feet long. You've now made it 13 feet long. You want to make that director string out in front have a 13-foot focal length instead of a 10-foot focal length. In order to do that, all of the elements have to become a little bit shorter. So just simply adding elements, people used to do that to a Yagi and say, hey, it runs out of steam, it doesn't have any more gain when I do that. Well, they weren't smart enough to realize that they needed a longer focal length when they made the Yagi longer, and all the elements had to be made shorter. So the bottom line of all this is, a long Yagi is a synthesized slow wave structure that has a particular velocity profile. The spacing of the element and the length of the elements along that boom, all of those directors, means that the amount of slowness of the wave going down the center of the boom is a different amount of velocity in different portions of that boom. When you plot that velocity versus position along the boom, you get a curve. It's called the velocity profile. If you design a Yagi that has the right velocity profile so that the focal length happens to be equal to the length of your boom, you've now got the maximum performance out of the Yagi. And to call it a magnifying glass, the fact that it fits the model where when you make it longer, all the elements have to be made shorter so that you have a longer focal length, it fits. It may be not a perfect theory, but it's good enough. It's allowed me to sign quite a number of patents, and some of them are in full-scale production right now, and they're working very well. So, a long Yagi is a magnifying glass. A short Yagi is something that enhances the wave going forward and cancels the wave going back. And at what length of Yagi do you switch over from one philosophy to the other? It turns out both work all the time. And somewhere in between three elements and let me pick a number, 10 elements, maybe the answer is around 5 elements or so, you have to flip over from the enhancement and cancellation philosophy over to the slow wave magnifying glass focusing philosophy. They both work. And you could explain the three-element Yagi also as a focusing device. I'll admit it's a lot more difficult to do that. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. All right, just make sure we understand the driven element or the actual element that's doing the receiving in your receive analysis. The elements forward of that, all of those directors are focusing the incoming signal onto that driven element or receiving element. The reflector's job is reflecting the signal back to a focus point also on that receiving element, correct? So that's basically the operation.
Give that man a cigar. You've got it. There's something a little bit more complicated going on, though. What you said is accurate. But now let's go down to one step further in the analysis. The thing that blew my mind is that when I really finally finished with my ratiometry antenna range, if you look at the, I keep forgetting what year it is, I think it's 1978, I think it's the May issue of QST Magazine. There's an article by K2RIW called Antenna Ratiometry and Outdoor Range Improvement Technique. When you use that kind of outdoor range technique, you can now resolve with accuracy whether or not the gain of your antenna that you're tweaking has gone up or down 0.05 dB, a 20th of a dB. A properly tuned ratiometry outdoor antenna range can tell you whether or not your antenna has gone up or down a 20th of a dB, 0.05 dB. When you've got that as a design tool and you're tweaking an antenna, very rapidly find out whether or not each individual element should be a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, a little bit further forward, a little bit further back in order to maximize the gain of the antenna right now. You're getting the answer in real time. And if you're smart enough to do it with a voltage to tone converter where the amplitude of the signal being received is being converted to a tone, and as the signal gets stronger, the tone goes higher in pitch. So you do whatever tuning is required. You don't even have to be near the instrumentation. You don't have to look at the dials. Just with your hearing, as you're tuning the antenna, you know right away whether the gain went up or down because the tone coming out of your piece of test equipment went up or down. Beautiful way of doing things. Let me drop. Yeah, we should put that on the website. Somebody just said that on the input. Let me think now. Is that article on the website? I gotta check. It might be there. You're talking about the LimonTechNet.com. Is that article there? I'm going to make sure the article is there. It's ratiometry and center range technique. Okay. When you're doing that technique, that was the point I was going to make. It's a very strong point. All of a sudden, I've lost it. Let me think for a minute. Oh, yes. If you've now got a well-tuned Yagi, a 19-element or an 18-element Yagi, you've got everything tuned just right, and you've squeezed the last 20th of a dB of gain you can get out of it, good common sense would tell you that if you suddenly rip off the reflector, and you're going to get a little bit of change of the driven element, and you readjust the impedance match to the driven element, but you ripped off the reflector. So all of the signal that would have been radiated in the rearward direction, that would have been canceled, is no longer canceled. The dipole is issuing half of its signal forward, half of its signal back, and all of the signal going back that used to be canceled, you've not canceled it anymore because you ripped the dipole off. Good common sense tells you if you do that, rip off the dipole, you must lose 3 dB of gain. Good common sense. You set up your antenna, ratiometry antenna range, and you rip off the dipole, you rip off the reflector, you expect 3 dB of gain decrease, and you get 3/10 of a dB of gain decrease. You say to yourself, what in the world is going on? Do I really need a reflector? Absolutely. 3 or 4/10 of a dB is coming by the reflector being there or not being there. But now, all of that signal in the back hemisphere that used to get canceled ain't being canceled anymore because I've removed the reflector. And I got such a small change. I got a detriment, but nowhere near as detriment as I expected. What's going on? And here, the best way to analyze it, again, is the magnifying glass. When you're receiving that signal from space, that great big long string of directors out there, 16 of them in that Yagi of mine, let me drop, are taking, even though the 432 megacycle Yagi has elements that are roughly 12 inches long, half wavelength to 432, roughly 12 inches. And if you now analyze the capture area of that antenna, and I've done that, I've carefully measured it, theoretically, in reality, whatever. That antenna is acting like a magnifying glass that is 5.7 feet in diameter. As long as the signal is horizontally polarized on the light frequency coming down the bore side of that antenna, you take all of the energy from a 5.7 foot diameter circle of space, take all of that energy, and that director string focuses all down to the driven element. A little bit of that energy spills over the driven element and goes back and hits the reflector and gets re-reflected forward. But most of it is focused on the driven element and stays there. You yank off that director, you lose a few tenths of a dB of gain. The capture area of that magnifying glass of those 16 directors out in front is still there. So, which element of the Yagi works the hardest? They all work pretty hard. But you've got 16 directors out in front and only one or two reflectors out in back. They don't work that hard. But if you look at it from an area relationship, all of a sudden it makes more sense. So, in the case of a three-element Yagi, the reflector is a lot more important. You don't have as much focusing going on with only one director out in front. Let me drop. So, how hard is the reflector working? To answer that question, you have to ask the next question, how many directors are you using? And are they properly tuned? KC2WGB, K2RIW on the tech dad.
Well, other than the fact that the reflector is rejecting the unwanted signals, it's only beneficial for 3 or 4 tenths of a dB in advancing the signal. That I wasn't aware of. Very interesting. Let me let it drop. We'll go to the next one. KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, another antenna question. This is at 440 megahertz, vertically polarized antenna, like something like a whip. Now, he wants to know, he wants to take something like a cylinder, cut it in half, so now he has a curved structure. He wants to put it behind the antenna, and he wants to know if that will increase the gain of the vertical antenna by reflecting the signal. He understands that he would have to space it properly to make sure that he gets the right wavelength coupling to the antenna. But he'd like to build this, and do you think it's a waste of time, or do you think he should try it and see what happens? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Don, good question. And the answer is yes and no. Depends on how big the antenna is. When you take a long driven element, and it could be a collinear element, and you put a parabolically shaped cylindrical surface behind it, you could call that a trough antenna. You could call it a parabolic cylinder, parabolic center cylinder antenna. And when it comes to one of the world-class radio telescopes in the early days of radio astronomy, the Vermilion River Radio Telescope, done by the Illinois University of Technology, wait a minute, no, Illini's, the Chicago area, but the University of Illinois has somewhere on one of their pieces of property this cylindrical parabolic shaped surface cut in the ground where I'm guessing that cylinder is in the vicinity of, I'm going to guess, 60 feet wide and probably 300, 400 feet long. And in front of that, aimed up in the sky, is this dipole array, a collinear array. That's called the Vermilion River Radio Telescope. So that thing has a beautiful high-gain pattern, and it's massive. So if you build a cylinder big enough, you'll get a lot of gain out of it, no two ways. See, what's going on here is that if I decide to make a parabolic dish antenna, let me drop. I could take a slice through a parabolic dish antenna, vertically or horizontally, and each one of those slices would be a perfect parabola. So it's a parabola of revolution. And you put a dipole-like structure or a horn-like structure at the focal point of that parabolic dish, and you and I have got a very high-gain dish antenna. If you take a look at the front cover of the August issue, 1972 QST magazine, you'll see me standing on a picnic table with a 12-foot diameter dish antenna, homebrew, made out of a chicken wire, or was it window screening, I think, in those days, and eventually I used that antenna to listen to the Apollo astronauts. That became a 36 dB gain antenna at 2.4 gigahertz to listen to the command service module. So a parabolic-shaped device gives you a predictable amount of gain. The parabola doesn't have to be a parabola of revolution. It could be a cylindrical parabola as long as you've got a lined feed. That's the good news. Here comes the not-so-good news. Let me drop. You're looking at it from an area relationship. And you're using good common sense. The area of that cylindrical parabolic surface looks like it's increasing the area of your vertical whip antenna. And it is. But how fast? How much bang are you getting for the dollar, so to speak? Bear in mind now that a simple dipole piece of wire, 80-meter dipole, 132 feet long, has an area of 8,500 square feet. The dipole is in free space, and if your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked at it, you would see a great big oval in space that's pitch black. The oval would be about 30% wider than the length of the dipole, and half as high, that great big black oval in space, all the energy in that chunk of space gets sucked up by that piece of wire because of the magic of resonance, and all that energy goes onto that wire, goes down the feed line, and pegs the signal strength meter on your receiver. So a simple piece of wire has a huge amount of radio area that your eye doesn't see. That piece of wire of the 80-meter dipole casts a shadow on the ground at high noon of 1 square foot because it's made out of 14-gauge wire. But it has a real radio area of 8,500 square feet. You go to higher frequencies where the wavelengths are shorter, you don't get quite as much area, but you get a similar relationship. So that whip antenna has almost as much area as your cylinder that you're about to build. So your cylinder is not going to do much until you make it very big. If you simply put a second whip behind the first whip and feed them as a phased array, let me drop. You put the second whip behind the first whip and you make the two whips a quarter of a wavelength separated and use a power divider and a slightly longer piece of cable to one versus the other, so you feed the signals to the two antennas 90 degrees out of phase. So you've got a spatial spacing of the two antennas, quarter wavelength, which means 90 degrees, and electronically you send them 90 degrees out of phase. You'll now get a beautiful cardioid pattern. You'll have a beautiful forward lobe, and you'll have a null in the back direction. You will make as much area of the antenna as that great big sheet of metal that you were about to build. A simple second rip, properly spaced and properly fed, will give you as much and maybe a little bit more area than the great big cylinder you were about to build. The cylinder you're about to build is going to have a whole lot of wind load, and for you to make it strong enough so that it doesn't blow down in a hurricane is a little bit of a problem. Let me drop. So until you make that cylinder many times larger than your first impression, you are not going to be gaining anything over the second whip, if you know what I mean. Now you redesign that antenna so that the cylinder is, let me pick a number, 50 feet wide, 50 feet high. And now you're going to get a hell of a lot more gain than just two whips. So once you understand the area relationship on simple antennas, it's amazing how simple a mechanical structure can give you a hell of a lot more area. In the case of the three-element Yagi, when you did it at 915 megacycles, it is gathering energy from a 6-inch diameter of space, even though each of the elements is only 3.5 or 4 inches long. So by very, very simple techniques, once you understand the theory of operation of Yagi or phased arrays, you can develop a hell of a lot area radio-wise that your eye doesn't see. So will the cylinder work? Absolutely. Is it the best way to do it? Until you build it big enough, I don't recommend you go that way. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the deck net.
KC2WGB. Well, I think you saved them a lot of time, because what he's looking to do is he was going to build the reflector part, maybe a total of 3 square feet. Just don't forget this is 440 megahertz. He would be better off fashioning, like you said, another dipole, another vertical antenna or whip, and mount it that quarter wavelength and use that, because he was going to pan around with the reflector to control the direction of the antenna. So I think your suggestion is better for him. I think it's easier to build, less wind resistant, and it should work well. Okay. Very good.
To build a structure so that those two whips are quarter wavelength apart, one can move with reference to the other, so you change the direction of arrival of the main signal, so to speak. You steer the beam. Mechanically, that's a lot easier, and electronically, you're going to be doing the exact same thing. This is one of those areas where we amateurs, the one thing that we don't do anywhere near enough is to look at an antenna from an area relationship radio-wise. Any antenna that you know the gain of, there is a very exact formula that tells you exactly how much radio area it has. Area equals gain lambda squared divided by 4 pi. Area equals gain lambda squared divided by 4 pi. The gain must not be in decibels. It must be unlogged and expressed as a real number. And whatever units you use for lambda, that's the unit you're going to get. If you use lambda in meters, then you're going to get an answer in square meters. So gain lambda squared divided by 4 pi. If you know the gain of your antenna, and if the manufacturer of that antenna was telling you the truth, there's another thing to worry about. If he's telling you the truth, then by that formula, you can calculate the exact area that antenna's got. You know that 80-meter dipole, let me drop. Any properly built dipole that's far enough away from the ground so that it's in free space will have a gain of 2.14 dB. That's the gain in dB. Convert dBs into a real number by anti-logging it, and 2.14 dB, I think, is 1.64. So the gain is 1.64. Lambda is 80 meters. You square that, divide by 4 pi, and you'll come up with 8,500 square feet. Every antenna you know the gain of, you can calculate its area. That's what the radio wave sees, even though your eye doesn't see that. Once you know the area relationship, you can make a hell of a lot of decisions right off the bat. Should I build the antenna this way? Should I build it that way? If you build it the first way, the common sense way, you'll end up with great big